David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 436. I'm your host, Sergeant Steve Raker, hunkered down in the comic book bunker along with Howler's WWX Kevin, Demolitions, and our own Robo Dugan, Andrew the LA Rabbit.
Robo Dugan forever, Steve. I'll never forget. I'll never forget.
Marvel Noise is a semi-monthly podcast. Sponsored by nobody. But we worship at the altar of Derek Coward's Deliberate Noise Network that hosts our show and many others. One being Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show where we talk up the indie books that we're digging. Even manga. And Valiant. Sometimes.
Maybe a little bit too much Image. I blame Kevin.
A little too much DC, Andrew.
Never enough DC.
Well, since March, we've been covering Peter David's Captain Marvel series from the turn of the century. We hit the first 13 issues, plus the zero issue, Kevin, on episode 430, and issues 14 to 25 on episode 434. This episode, we aim to finish up the first series, because there were two, with issues 26 to 35, all of them written by Peter David. And these ones came out from December 2001 to August 2002. Our cast is small. This is all about character. And dialogue and character moments the cast is really three main stars and two supporting characters. We've got Genus, who is Captain Marvel, aka Marv. He's the test tube bred spawn of the original Captain Marvel. Well, not the big cheese, but the original Marvel Captain Marvel. And Rick Jones, he's tied forever to the Marvel Universe by being there and being part of the creation of the Hulk. He's partnered with Captain America. He was bonded to Captain Marvel for a while, and he was even pals with Rom Space Knight.
What about the Team Brigade, Steve? It's number one credit.
There's also Marlo, who is Rick's estranged but now reunited wife back from the dead and owning a comic book shop, adding to a lot of industry and customer side humor. Then the supporting characters are Moondragon, the telekinetic, telepathic Avenger Titan, who is hanging out and living with Marlo, and Lorraine, who is a ghost for the second time haunting Marlo, killed by Rick Jones's homicidal maybe mom.
So, you know, I was trying to find out if these issues had been collected, like originally when they came out. And it was hard to find. Like, all I could see was the run after this one. Because it's sort of like in that in-between realm where I'm not sure if Marvel was collecting absolutely everything at this point. Yeah, seemed like some things had slipped through the cracks.
And there was still some austerity measures that were happening at the time, you know? Like, the first six issues, I think, were, or the first five with the zero issue, were collected. But then not after that. From this first run. But issue 26 was a nuff said issue, meaning there were no words.
Rolled off a lot of words in the background on every building surface, signage and everything. I feel like it was a tiny bit of a cheat, maybe. I don't know. Just saying.
Well, it was a line-wide stunt that month, so all of the comics had no words, so it was definitely stunty.
Yeah, you know? I can't say this is one of my favorite ones. I mean, I think this specific title works a little better with funny words in it.
They do have the ability to do the reflections back and forth between Marv and Rick, which I think they did with some success, I would think. And the art team on this issue was Leonard Kirk and Robin Riggs.
Yeah, I get, okay, after 25, you need a break. Because, you know, back in the day when they did Anniversary, when they made it to 25, they would. So I get, and I normally like Leonard Kirk. I don't know if it was normally the digital works okay, or if the digital wasn't his friend or whatever. But I was like, really, I normally like Leonard Kirk more than I like him in this story. And I don't know if it was me, him, or what. Or I don't know, maybe the anchors. I don't know. It was weird. I was like, boy, I liked his. He did that Alpha Flight thing about a decade ago that I liked.
I like that, like you said, after the 25th issue, rather than getting a inventory story or something, they at least something kind of major happened. I mean, it's like it was a surprise. Like they didn't restore one-armed old man Rick Jones in the milestone issue 25. They simply waited until the next issue, right?
Well, that way it can get its whole thing. But it's so weird. We're in, what did you say, 2001 this is approximately, Steve?
Yes, yeah.
And the plot point, he goes into this pawn shop. On the top shelf of the pawn shop in 2001, he has a rack of cassette Walkmans. I mean, I'm telling you, 2001, the street value of a cassette Walkman might have been $5. I don't think that needed the top shelf placement in the pawn shop, but...
Yeah,
but maybe they're collector's items.
Rick is destitute when the issue opens and he's like lying in the gutter. Some kid steals his loose negaband because he can only wear one. The other one was like dangling from his belt because he's one-armed. And the kid hawks it for money at the pawn shop. But then he feels guilty and returns the money and looks for Rick to give it back. But Rick, meanwhile, after contemplating suicide, stumbles upon a homeless woman giving birth unattended in an alleyway. And he helps her give birth. It's almost a stillborn too, but he gives baby CPR, which ain't easy. And the guy who stole the negabands finds them in the alley and he's the father. Ta-da! So.
Yeah, it had that, the vibe when, Tony Stark was an alcoholic living on the streets and had that crew, and it really gave me that whole, like, before the big showdown with Stain. And all
comic
that.
Book drunk.
Yeah, with the beard and all that stuff. They're always little families and everything, but yeah, I enjoyed how. And look, they had to get him back to, like, regular. So yeah. I'm with Kevin. This wasn't my favorite issue or anything, but yeah, it gets him back to status quo.
Yeah, it also reminds me, it's like, and now time for that special Christmas episode or something
right,
like that.
Right.
It's like, but one here, of those one-offs.
The you know, climax is that when Marv clicks the bands together, Rick is restored. He's got his arm and he's young again. Yay. Issues 27 to 30 is the four-part Time Flies arc that has covers by J.H. Williams and Jose Villaburin. I mean, it looks like something out of Promethea here.
Yeah, this is pretty weird. I also remember these covers pretty well because they were included with action figures.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so
toys are the best.
Yeah, I don't know if they did all four, but I definitely remember at least two of them, I'm pretty sure, because I these were pretty familiar.
Like what scale figures, Kevin?
Oh, the Marvel Legends, like,
oh,
it, nice. I'm trying to, maybe it was, would they have stuck one with the Maestro, and maybe they stuck another one with Captain Marvel? I don't know. I'm not quite sure on the timeline there, but
yeah, that could be.
Yeah.
I mean, this is early Marvel Legends time, right? I mean,
yeah.
There were some very sweet, like, I will say this era had sweet covers. Kevin knows I need to do this, but across the street, James Jean was doing those Fables covers about this time. Just really pretty. I always think of this era as like the very nice, pretty painted covers by all these different great artists. I mean, not the inside are bad, but it is always weird when you go from this like beautiful set piece and then you're back into a comic book.
But I wouldn't have been disappointed. This is the difference. Like, I look at that great cover, and then I look inside, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the artwork I like.
Yeah.
I like the artwork, but that's Star Fox design. It's more disappointing
if you're getting, I don't know, like Jim Lee, and then you look inside, and it's like, I've never heard of this guy. Like, maybe you would be.
Star Fox is tough because the original design wasn't so great, and this design is pretty bad, terrible, too. And then the current Marvel Universe design is really whacked, so, I don't know. And the art here is Chris Cross and Annabelle Rodriguez doing most of the issues, but issue 28 has fill in with Chris Batista and Rich Parada.
It made me jump, though, Steve.
Star Fox is attacked. He gets the Spear of Destiny through the throat by Thanatos, who saw from Spider-Man 2099, 11 to 13, back in 1993, 8 years earlier, but also written by Peter David.
I don't think we covered those issues.
Star Fox appears at Marlowe's comic store on the toilet, covering a temporal whirlpool, which Marlowe eventually flushes, and Star Fox and Marv get sucked in.
Of course. Who hasn't gotten sucked into a toilet?
I've at least had a dream, right? Like, no, not the Tidy Bowl Man again. But they get transported to the future where they meet Spider-Man 2099, Peter David wrote. So that's fun.
Yeah, I was excited to see Spider-Man 2099. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's also funny reading 26 and 27 if you look at how one team portrays Marlowe and Rick Jones, and then when the regular guys get back, they're like, oh no, he didn't look like that, he looks like this. They make a few jokes about his haircut and everything, I think, to kind of bridge that gap between how different they look.
Thanatos, who is a big muscular dude in like limited Greek armor, golden armor at bat, kind of like a Magog kind of a thing, you know, with his presence. Yeah. But he attacks Tyler Stone at Alchemex. He wants the time machine that they're studying, which is Doom's time platform, because he wants to end civilization as they know it. So when Spidey and Marv and Star Fox finally make it to his location at Alchemex, he transports Spidey and Marv with Doom's time machine to the future imperfect reality, where they have to face off against the Maestro, which Peter David also wrote.
I will say it's the era of digital and everything, but I think that the art team really hits it with the 2099 futuristic buildings. Sometimes that stuff can come off kind of sterile and fakey, but I think 2099 world is kind of sterile, so I thought it worked really well in contrast with how expressive the figures are. Like, they're really super cartoony, and like you said, Steve, this guy's got muscles on top of his muscles, so that was nice juxtaposition against the kind of like high-tech fancy 2099 background.
Yeah, the Star Fox neck thing is where you really get the computer digital thing, and I'm like,
yeah, you open
doesn't
up
work so great.
Same thing in the toilet, same effect, use both spots. Thanatos brought Rick Jones to this future as well, and brings him to meet the old wheelchair bound Rick Jones from Future Imperfect, and then reveals that he too is a Rick Jones.
What?
Well, it was in his reality, after the Kree-Skrull War, he stays with the Supreme Intelligence and, like, trains to hone his weird destiny powers and went bad, maybe mad, and killed the Supreme Intelligence and has been on a path of destruction ever since. Star Fox was also brought to the Future Imperfect future, and his task is to retrieve the Eye of Agamotto amulet from the Maestro's legendary trophy room. Thanatos is beaten by a well-set-up gag. He earlier had asked Rick how he got Mjolnir into the display case in the trophy room, but it's kind of passed off as like a wisecrack, like, hey, how'd you get it there? And as a reader, you're like, hey, how would you get it there? But then at the climax of this arc, old Rick wields Mjolnir and defeats Thanatos with it.
Let me tell you, what I wanted to see more of was the Maestro fight. I feel like they looked really fun. Like, that's where this team, the exaggerated musculature, and he has the chain around him and everything. That part was a lot of fun visually, I thought. I was like, yeah, make him ridiculously oversized and everything. I don't know. I just thought with the Spider-Man 2099, Captain Marvel and Maestro fight was probably my favorite visuals in this little run.
That's what you were jonesing for.
Oh.
No, no, that would be the Thanatos old man Rick and regular Rick, I guess.
You know, I think David really showed his comfort with bringing in the 2099 and the Maestro stuff too, because he injected a fair amount of real estate to gags and humor throughout. Like, there's the bit with Thanatos talking about being in the 22nd century and Spider-Man 2099 and Tyler Stone have a back and forth of like, no, actually this is the 21st century. And this, yeah. And because there was no year zero, you start from one. Yeah. I thought that was kind of funny.
Cause we were going through that then too. And I'm like, oh, here we go again here.
Right. We had just had the turn of ours. And there's another bit with, you know, playing up Spider-Man 2099's organic web shooters and like, whoa, they're organic. Like, that's crazy. You know, you'd never see that in a movie.
Yeah. There's a lot of little bits like that.
The best I thought was the Maestro having his face webbed up by Spider-Man 2099. And after he pulls it off and sees his opponent or assailant, he yells up to him, geez, where'd you get that costume anyway? A Day of the Dead festival? And Miguel, Spider-Man, is like, well, actually, yeah, as he did in his origin, also written by Peter David.
You know, I was kind of wondering, I'm not 100% sure on this, but if it's not the last appearance of Spider-Man 2099 before like someone else takes over, it's pretty close to the last.
Yeah. And Spider-Man 2099 wasn't still running at this point, right? It had long been.
Yeah. I think the bankruptcy killed pretty much most everything of that nature.
Yeah. A lot of books that were going like 50 issues or the Silver Surfer, like it almost made it to like the new era, but then it got canned too.
But it was fun that David brought the characters that he are developing in this book, which also are characters from his old Hulk book, and then played around with the other properties that he created and has nurtured over the years and did it in a fun four-issue arc, I thought.
Yeah, and I also wonder about the sales, because there's actually a reference to the sales in here too, like, oh, well, maybe the sales will go up if we do a 4-issue arc.
Everybody's doing it.
Yeah.
Issue number 31 features a Kevin Maguire Everything Marlowe cover, where Marvel Comics and Captain Marvel are replaced with the L-O, making them Marlowe and Captain Marlowe.
What's with the bogus thing on the... I remember this, too, with like the Wizard banner, and it's like Marvel's just like, oh yeah, I guess it's just the pick of the year, since Wizard won't really tell us what our award is.
The art inside is by Derek Oikoin. And here Marlowe flippantly wishes that she was dead, and she drops dead at the comic store. And the staff are all trying to revive her and everything, but fortunately Moondragon drops by and is able to do so. But Moondragon explains that, like, death was drawn to her because she's always been, like, she has the death wish of, like, living on the edge and living dangerously and all that. And they kind of go through some of Marlowe's past, including her lack of hesitation to confront Joe Fixit when the Hulk was working as a bouncer back in Vegas when she first was introduced in Peter David's Hulk book.
That's right.
And then Marv reappears at the end of the issue via Dr. Doom's time platform from 2099 and comments that now the rebels in old Rick's time, in the future imperfect time, will be able to use it to bring the Hulk forward to stop the Maestro once and for all, referring to the, you know, like setting the future imperfect story arc into motion, which was fun. So it was cool the way they connected all that. Throughout these issues also, there's been this subplot of Rick's crazy maybe mom still trying to kill Marlowe and him. And Marlowe knows that she's back, but she hasn't told Rick. And this woman comes to the comic store asking for Marlowe, and she's like, oh, okay, I'll come back later. She's like, she'll be dying to see me, that kind of thing. When she does that, though, when she goes to the comic store, on the side of the register, scotch taped is the wraparound Steranko cover from the Captain America Index in the early 80s. Mm. And I did the same thing with mine. I pulled that cover off and I had it hanging on my wall as a youth. And I did the same for the X-Men Index cover. And that one still hangs on the bunker wall to this day.
I thought you were going to get another copy of Infinity War. And when the whole Marvel Universe is on those gatefold covers, you take that cover off.
Yeah, right. Now the my walls are all filled, though. No room for the current stuff, sorry. So Rick's crazy mom also tries to sneak attack Marlowe when she's receiving their new comic day delivery. But she gets saved the next issue by none other than who, Kevin?
JMS. Yes, that JMS. Kind of weird.
He shows up for his new comics on New Comic Day because they're in LA, right? Playing on the fact that he's a, you know, screenwriter and stuff. But this whole Marlowe dealing with Rick's crazy mom with a knife bit resolves in issue 32 when she shows up at Marlowe's apartment with a butcher knife, and Moondragon allows Lorraine the ghost to appear to her, and it frightens her backwards off the balcony, thud. And therein ends the threat of Rick Jones's weird homicidal maybe mom.
You know what, when the new comics were showing up, I'm like, oh, we're going to see some diamond boxes and everything. And then it was just regular short boxes. I'm like, okay, I guess the new comics can also be comics that you purchased and they look like back issues. It was just kind of strange.
Issues 32 to 34 feature art in issue 32 by Jim Califori and Mark McKenna under a really cosmic, cool-looking Ariel Olivetti cover. Issue 33 has Chris Cross and Rich Parada. And issue 34 has J.J. Kirby art. In this arc, Moondragon is teaching Marlowe self-awareness, control, and discipline through martial arts. And she gets the idea to copy Marlowe's perception so that she can see and interact with Lorraine too. And it works. And Marlo's so thrilled that, you know, she's not crazy. Someone else can see Lorraine, that she embraces Moondragon in a big hug. And then they have kind of a weird moment where they look into each other's eyes and then they kiss. And Lorraine is like a Frank Cho sketch cover, like outrage. Like, she's like, I think I'm spinning in my grave. But Rick walks in and then they got to like play it cool.
Yeah, very sitcom-y moment there. Of that.
That's for sure.
Marv and Rick have this great idea that Rick and Marlo should enjoy some romantic getaway time in the Microverse. And wham bam, he clanks his bands together and they're gone. Which is like bad timing, right? Because this moment just happened. And it doesn't even go well when they're there. At one point, Rick even questions her if there's another guy, and she's like, well, no, definitely not another guy.
The weird subplot I thought was strange is they bring back Star Fox and have a stunning reveal of Marvel's mom, who does not look like a mom in any sense. She looks like she's like 21 and a model or something. It was pretty crazy looking.
And why she could possibly exist, because she's supposed to be dead, isn't even revealed until over a dozen issues into the second series. It's strange. Just left scratching your head.
She's not what I picture when they said we're gonna have his mom show up.
Hey, it's Marvel Cosmic, expect the unexpected.
Gravity and has different effect on density and waistlines. Well, with Rick and Marlo occupied, Marv leaves Earth to look up his old pals Zug, Glib, and Stecky from the 1995 Nicieza-written, Ed Benez-drawn Captain Marvel series that had Genisville in it. And he finds their hangout pub in shambles and learn that Stecky, who's this gender-shifting entity who prefers her female form and even had a little short-lived fling with Genus, she's been kidnapped and is presumed dead by the Magus, who is Adam Warlock's purple evil twin.
Ah, no, not that guy again.
And they have a lot of fun. Like, they, again, make him exaggerated and kind of weirdly. I really like the portrayal of it. I mean, it's good to have him as a realistic, regular-looking dude, too, but it was fun to see him in this ghostly realm, kind of.
And we get to see all three different creative teams' version of him, because he's the reveal at the end of California's issue. Then we get to see him with, you know, Chris Cross doing it, and then at the end, Kirby, who also, not that Kirby, does a nice job, though, I think. His style is unique, so it has its own look, but he's a good storyteller. So the Magus is all like ephemeral, and he's collecting souls to restore him to physical reality. And he's holding Stecky hostage and wants Marv's soul to kind of like take him over the threshold and bring him full circle. But Marv is in a conundrum because Rick keeps calling to him to switch places and help rescue Marlo, who's captured on their island getaway paradise by these little fanged gremlin creatures. Marv defeats the Magus with the old tried and true overload the battery trick by giving his soul along with the weight of his cosmic awareness to the Magus, and, you know, it's too much.
Hey, there's aware, Steve, and then there's cosmically aware.
This is true.
Werewolf.
Werewolf. Their castle.
Issue 35 is the last issue of this first volume. And it features a really clever cover by Udon Studios that parodies the Ultimate Comics cover branding. And Ultimate Comics had only debuted the year before, so it was still a new a new look.
Yeah, and still some people are confused and like, what? Is this not in continuity?
Drawn by Patrick Zercher and Rich Parada, with Scott Hanna helping on the inks. Here we have Marv breaking into the subterranean complex that Marlo was kidnapped and brought to by the little gremlin guys. And she's hooked up to this machine that broadcasts pleasurable memories, which the little gremlin things absorb the endorphins or energy from somehow. And Marv reaches her, and then he and therefore Rick see the memory of Marlo kissing Moondragon broadcast on, like, the big screen. Marlo gets rescued, and, you know, she still says she loves Rick, but she's had this, like, soul connection moment with Moondragon and feels drawn to her, and Moondragon feels the same, so Rick is like, I'm not gonna be the third wheel here, and just has Marv fly off. And that's how the whole volume ends.
They were getting too bogged down with the Golden Orange comic book store, Steve.
So, you know, this, I thought this was a good chunk of issues. I liked the two longer story arcs, and I thought they resolved a couple of the dangling ongoing things, but the series just ended so abruptly and oddly that it made sense that it wasn't the end at all.
Of course, you had to decide after this, which is, well, I guess the other books had a chance, but.
You know, we got to do the other books, though, because that's the whole reason I wanted to do these books. I mean, I wanted to do those Micronaut issues, but those were kind of right at the beginning. And then, like, it's this next run that I don't honestly remember that well, other than some of the obvious visuals that were takeaways. But I'm looking forward to getting into them if we can convince Andrew to keep going. Only a little bit more,
though.
We're almost there. We're almost there.
But these were the best comics Wizard magazine voted of all time, or whatever, as they kept saying.
Anything to keep it alive. Anything to keep the make it look like it's a successful thing. Come read. Anything to get attention, right?
Yeah. I mean, 35 issues isn't shabby.
No. And we know that there's another, what, 20 or 25 or something, so.
Yeah, yeah. Then that takes an entirely different direction with a different set of artists.
Well, I look forward to seeing that.
Indeed.
But wait, that's not all. Our Captain Marvel bit was recorded several weeks ago, and we intended to release it in early July, but in the weeks that followed, a tree fell on my house during a strong thunderstorm. There were like tornadoes in the Adirondacks from the same cell, and I've been like getting my roof tarped and getting demolition and inspections done and whatnot, and this episode got put off, but here it is after unintentionally taking July off, and we've got a few recent reads before we finish up and put a bow on it and send it out, nailed flat, naturally.
Wait, the tree blew over, and yet one of the hosts has suspicious whirlwind powers? I'm not pointing any fingers or anything.
Hey, I was out of the country, you can't blame me.
That's even more suspicious.
So wait, Steve, you're a Golden Age Green Lantern, your weakness is wood?
Don't. What a weakness, huh?
I mean, maybe you're better off with the yellow.
It's like, I've got a toothpick here that's going to take care of things. All right, who's got something?
All right, I've got some. Recently, always sad when a in-store goes to online only. So I went the Earth 2 comic store. which won an Eisner like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, is wrapping up their online, their in-store, moving online. So I went to go just buy a comic, and they had a back issue sales. And so I grabbed a back issue, and was a recent read, but it's not a recent book. Boys, I grabbed Strange Tales number one. No, not that Strange Tales number one. The one from 1987.
Oh.
The 19-issue series. What's really sad is, like, it was just in, like, a, you know, a cheapo one. And I must have, like, I was reading comics in 87. It's a split book. This would have been my jam, but I just don't remember it. And sadly, Marvel Unlimited let me down. They only got one other issue.
Yeah.
Which is kind of sad. And this is a great series. So what drew me to it, other than I like Strange Tales and I like the thing, is in the split book, the first one is Brett Blevins. You know, I love that guy. And a Bill Mantlo's story.
Yeah.
I feel like Blevins didn't do a ton of comics. I mean, he probably did more than I realized, but obviously I think of him with like New Mutant, you know,
but
magic
he also,
and all that.
He did that Cloak and Dagger, part of that Cloak and Dagger series after Rick Leonardi. He did some issues, and when Marvel canceled the Cloak and Dagger series and Doctor Strange's solo series that Roger Stern had been writing, they combined the two storylines into that almost 20-issue split book and called it Strange Tales. So it was Doctor Strange and Cloak and Dagger for the arc. And I think there was some Kevin Nolan in there in the Cloak and Dagger stuff later on, or maybe it was just covers, but some of that stuff is interesting, and it's been traded separately. Like the Cloak and Dagger stuff is in a trade and the Doctor Strange stuff is in a trade, but that might make it funky for the Marvel Unlimited, the way they do their reprints, you know? Usually yeah, if it's in a trade, it's on the Marvel Unlimited, right?
I was just like, oh, this would be perfect. You know, 19 issues. It's not a burden, but, and if they remastered it for trade, you're right. You think they'd upload it, but the Doctor Strange start is the Peter Gillis, Chris Warner, Randy Eberlin. So it was just really fun to be like, wait, I kind of vaguely remember this. And Blevins is just like a Cloak and Dagger type of character. He's going to make both of them look very exaggerated and kind of demonic. And I just really liked his artwork. So I was very pleased when I got this. And it was more just, I wanted to buy, buy something. You're there. And I bought, I don't know, some kind of terrible Image comic book that was current. But I wanted to, buy an old issue or something in this one. And very pleased with it. Like his proportions are always a little bit off in that way that exaggerates it perfectly. And then, the Doctor Strange story. It's Strange Tales, man. Doctor Strange is, that was where he started. So I felt like, that's pretty cool. Plus it was a fake out, cause I said Strange Tales number one. And I thought you guys would be like, whoa, look at Andy getting comics from the '50s.
Or it could have been the indie one from the 2000s.
Yes. Well, I think we've talked about indie that. One. I think we've talked about that one.
Yeah. Well, like 20 years ago.
As also long time listeners know, my thing is I'm not huge into the pre-split book Strange Tales at Marvel anyway, like when they were those monster and horror anthologies. Like obviously I like the ones that have something like Bernie Kriegstein did some, and I know Ditko and that kind of thing, but generally the stories in those are not my jam, those little O. Henry ironic twists. But yeah, Strange Tales number one from 1987. Why don't I remember the series? We'll never know. Maybe I didn't buy it. Maybe I was too cheap, but geez, this seems like it was right up my wheelhouse. So anyways, I might run down the other issues if I find them on the cheap, but always weird when it's not in the on the Unlimited. Something like this where, like, is it a rights thing or something weird?
That was his first big depowering too. Like his series and solo series ended with this Uthrona fellow coming and challenging him. I don't know if he had been Sorcerer Supreme for the right to be Sorcerer Supreme, I guess, and won. And Doc had to sacrifice all of the all his artifacts and sources of power in order to not let them fall into Uthrona's hands. And so this is like the depowered Doctor Strange. He might have even had the patch eye by then, or maybe he gets it during this season. But this same creative team starts off the Doctor Strange Sorcerer Supreme title for the first couple of issues, at least. And I think in those issues, he gets his eye restored. So somewhere he's got the patch for a bunch of issues, but it's a funny transitional time for the Doc.
Yeah, for some reason, I don't know why, I think of Peter Gillis as a DC guy too, but
really,
yeah, just more my own.
That's, I mean, Peter B. Gillis to you.
Yeah, clearly, if I'm not gonna, but yeah, fun stuff. A big recommend. But I'm always wary when it's not on the Unlimited or and it's some complicated, you got to run this nonsense down in long boxes or whatever, which isn't the worst thing. But come on, Marvel, put this on Unlimited. Although it's not going to beat seeing it on the old printed page.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll put that out in like an Epic or a Marvel Masterworks or something, because it's not the biggest thing.
No, 19 inch, and like if they already did it, they could do it as the split thing. Although I'd like to keep them both together. To be
I have honest. Them as paperbacks. They're both trade paperbacks, and if they do it in the Marvel Masterworks, it'll be the next volume because they just did the post Paul Smith issues in this most recent Marvel Masterworks. Because I got the Paul Smith edition, and then I looked at this next one. I'm like, "Ooh, do I need this one too?" And it's like, "No, it's already past the Paul Smith stuff." So then that leads into the Uthrona, and next up is these tales. So I assume they'd be able to throw the whole thing into one Masterworks.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. You know what else I have to see?
What?
Well, sometimes people go into Marvel and Evergreens, which is a little weird of a conversation, since, you know, some of their popular books have had multiple printings. But I mean, I guess it's not at its 100th printing, or and their stuff goes out of print. So I mean, I guess I can understand to a point. You know, sometimes it's the argument, well, they have a huge run, but they don't have like that one solo book that doesn't have any continuity in it. And I'm like, I guess so. I mean, I'll take a run, a long run, that's great over like one book any day, of course. But, you know.
Come on. The best things about those short-lived series that had nothing to do with the Marvel Universe otherwise were the couple of guest appearances that tied it to the Marvel Universe, right? Like US One or you know, Team America having the Ghost Rider in it, or you know, that kind of stuff. That one Spider-Man appearance, or like in Transformers, or that they were always that was part of the fun of Marvel doing this thing, is they would give you a connection and a tie-in, I think.
So I had to check out how Marvel would be stocked in a foreign bookstore. So I happened to stumble upon this one display that was a Kree Skrull War, a Kraven's Last Hunt, and then Daredevil Born Again. And I'm like, they got to figure it out. I mean, that's not a bad selection.
But steeped in the gravitas of continuity.
I mean, that is true. I mean, it is. But like that sticks with like the runs and continuing series. I'm like, yeah, it's just pulled from an era. But I'm like, what do you want to be reading? I mean, you probably want to be reading Kraven's Last Hunt. Like, I don't think anyone's going to argue that point.
How about the first Munch Sienkiewicz Moon Knight series? It's pretty self-contained. I mean, there is a Daredevil appearance in one issue, and a werewolf by night later on, but it's pretty self-contained and not steeped in continuity, and reads with a lot of done in one issues. And I think that's a pretty tight series.
That's pretty good
for an evergreen kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I'd almost say the same of the first dozen issues, if not more, of the Micronauts book. That was pretty tight, where the issue 12, I think, was finally revealed what the deal was with the Enigma Force and the Time Traveler and all that. And I thought that was a cool book with the Tales of the Microverse in the back that helped flesh things out and whatnot. Michael Golden art, Mantlo Golden.
I think some of the more modern stuff sometimes like works in that way. Like if you have your like Ultimate Spider-Man or your like sure. Runaways or whatever, like.
I mean, probably like New Universe books too, right?
That's right. They're going to have to reprint those someday. I mean, eventually they're like, we got nothing else to do.
I was looking and I was shocked that those aren't all on the Unlimited too.
No, I'm not shocked.
Because I was feeling a little nostalgic because I remember going in big. Although what I don't remember is that it actually lasted longer than I thought. I forgot. Like, I thought they all died after a year, but a few of them hung out for like 3 years or something like that. Limped along. Because I think I bailed after a year or two.
How about Tomb of Dracula as an evergreen book? I mean, that has a Doctor Strange and a Silver Surfer appearance at one point, but that's a pretty... I mean, it hasn't been an evergreen book, but it could be.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is very specific, but also exactly what you want if you're into that type of thing.
I also don't know how the license would work, but the Savage Sword and the Conan stuff is pretty evergreeny.
Yeah, that's true. I say to myself very frequently that I just almost feel like stopping reading everything except for going back and reading like a lot of Conan.
That's your retirement thing. It's like Ed Brubaker. I'm just going to write Archie. You're just going to read Conan. I took a gander at the newsstand too, and Spider-Man was still there like 30 years ago when I happened to get an issue of Spider-Man that my parents bought for me, and I couldn't understand a word in it. And I'm like, this is a forward Spider-Man comic, but I'm like, but it's McFarlane. And it was a few years behind. This Spider-Man issue was also a few years behind. It was the Nick Spencer run.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they had put three Amazing Spider-Man issues in one issue. And it was somewhat cheaper than our stuff, but I wouldn't say it was like way cheaper, but it you know, rather than you buying the three issues by themselves. I mean, I think you would have came out ahead.
Did you buy one or two just for fun?
I was so going to buy that Spider-Man one, but I didn't. I'm like, it was that incomprehensible Spider-Man 2099 that Nick Spencer did. So I actually didn't pick that one up, and I found the back issue later on. That was a Spider-Man back issue, so I have that instead. I'm like, I thought that was a better representation of my love of Spider-Man than that other thing.
All right, well, next time I expect you to have learned a new language by studying the different comics.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, I learned to read from comics. You can too.
Whenever I buy a foreign edition, I'm always like, this is going to be the one, and it never is.
Yeah, it's weird when you see them though, because then you're like, sometimes you're like, this is a super valuable issue in another language.
I learned all my German from Sergeant Fury comics.
Well, at least you know what danger is.
Yep. And you know, come here fast.
Yes.
Schnell.
Are you confusing it with Hogan's Heroes, Steve?
Oh, good old Hogan's Heroes. Or F Troop. I read, caught up on Al Ewing's Immortal Thor book, which we have talked about some of those first issues with the giant, almost like a wood god kind of alternate Thors and Lokis, the Utgard Thor and the Utgard Loki and all that, and the big god wheel thing and bringing the big storm. And we definitely was compelling and the art was good, and we wanted to sort of see where it went from there. And I kind of let the issues pile up. So I dove into issues 5 to 10, plus a one shot. I'll get to that. But all written by Al Ewing. And in the fifth issue, it kind of finishes up the Utgard Thor conflict, and it takes a new Thor core. If you remember back in the Tom DeFalco, Ron Frenz days, they made a Thor core that was like all the different versions of Thor, like Thor and like future Thor and young Thor and Beta Ray Bill, and the red bearded Thor was still alive then. I forget what his name was, but anyway, they had their team, and now there's a new Thor core, and it's Thor, Beta Ray Bill, Loki, Valkyrie, who is Jane Foster, but when she holds Mjolnir, she's Thor again, and Storm, who brings the storm, Nuff said. So it takes all of them to defeat Utgard Thor. And, oh, I should have mentioned, too, the art is by Martin Kokulo. And they defeat him in a, you know, not altogether physical way, even though they most of the issue is them trying physical means. But they end up giving him a taste of being worthy, of what it means to be Thor being worthy. And it's like the Ghost Rider's pen and stare to Utgard Thor, which sends him running. Issue 6 is a look back at younger Thor and Loki in a Jack and the Beanstalk kind of adventure that serves at the end to be a comic within a comic, because the Enchantress is using the printed page to alter reality with magic. And she's connecting with the Roxxon Minotaur, and she's got the Executioner by her side again.
Yeah, this is pretty wild. I mean, Thor still surprises me, and that's good.
In the seventh issue, Thor and Loki travel to Utgard and confront Utgard Loki, and are left pondering the question, so then is there an Utgard Odin? And if so, where is he? Fruit for future story. In issue 8, Thor confronts his mother, Gaia, the spirit of the earth, about her role in this whole Utgard mess, because she's definitely has her hands involved. And most of this issue ends up being her, you know, telling Thor about how it is and how it went down. And with it, we get a really great cosmic history section that where, like, you know, they both present and reveal a bunch of history, which is kind of neat. And Ibram Robertson does the art in this issue and the next. Then issues 9 and 10 have Thor facing off against the Enchantress and the Executioner and the Roxxon Minotaur. And that is paired with a it kind of like finalizes in a one shot that's called Roxxon Presents Thor Number 1, where Thor has to face his Roxxon Comics doppelganger. And the whole thing is fun comic booking. I mean, is it the best Thor ever? Is it even taking the best of Thor comics and putting it together in a new run? No, but it's telling some cool stories and some different kind of stories, and they're intriguing, and Thor is acting in character. It's definitely connected to the Marvel Universe, well as the use of Loki and other characters that have been brought in, Storm and things like that. It's a good Al Ewing book.
Are they allowed to publish something like that, though?
I mean, Roxxon? No, they had to have a deal with Marvel.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little meta at times and commenting on stuff, and I'm like, ooh, you snuck that one in. Or I don't know. I guess it depends on your opinion on Marvel, but at times I'm like, I guess you can do that. No one's watching.
I just think, you know, you could go into writing a Thor series and say, I'm the new writer on Thor. What's my checklist of things I want to make sure I get in there? Oh, I want to make sure I get, you know, the Mangog, and I want to make sure I get this character, and I always love this character, make sure I get them all in. Ewing's gone straight to, I have this other story to tell about Thor with these other kinds of characters. And yes, they're versions of Thor and whatever, but he's manipulating the pieces that are already in play in the sandbox, as it were, right? But it's fun, and it doesn't feel derivative, even though, I mean, when he does get around, or the next writer gets around to doing some more sort of derivative type Thor stuff, it'll probably be like a breath of fresh air after doing a whole bunch of other kinds of stories like this. I don't know. I think it's cool.
I think it's what you should be doing. Like when you come onto a book like that.
Verily. But you know how it is, right? Like you're coming onto a Spider-Man book and you're like, oh, well, Doc Ock hasn't been seen in a while, or this character, or that, like, we got to bring these back. And there's probably editorial is whispering in your ear, oh, we got to use this character and that character.
Yeah, I feel like Green Goblin's stuck in that cycle where it's like, oh, it's issue 50. Green Goblin's back. And I'm like, again?
Kevin, we went a really long time without any Norman Osborn, and it was okay.
It was.
We had the Hobgoblin. That was kind of fun for a little while. And we had no Goblin for a while, and that was okay, too.
You know, part of the other people don't, like, you carry baggage with you, and you try not to, like, get in your way, at least I try not to get in my own way. I mean, other people let their own baggage, like, weigh them down. But, I mean, I try not to, whatever I'm bringing to the story, but with the whole Norman not being around, and I was totally invested in Harry and his struggles with the Goblin.
Yeah,
and then we had the awesome Hobgoblin, and then you have Norman, and I'm just like, all right, Norman's back. That's great. And then it's not like he came back and had all the great stories for a long time.
No. So I think
I was perfectly satisfied with what we had, and we didn't need anything else.
Totally. I mean, the vacuum of Norman and the Green Goblin was filled with the creation of Venom, I think, because all of a sudden there was another big villain that was popular that was making multiple appearances and stuff. Meanwhile,
and also knew his identity. That was always a key tension of the Green Goblin thing. Yeah. And that's right. Venom also knew his identity.
Yep.
And over in Spectacular Spider-Man, you had Mark DeMatteis and Sal Buscema doing the Harry stuff with the Goblin, where, you know, doing their very cinematic. Remember when Buscema and Mark DeMatteis were doing those really cinematic issues where they'd have all those panels, like, you know, with Vermin and and those Harry Goblin. Totally.
Yeah.
That was great stuff.
It was.
And then Norman came back.
I know. And then for a long time, I was like, maybe he's just like the Chameleon's ultimate plot. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be a great reveal when he's really the Chameleon.
Nope. Sorry. Spider-Man's parents were the robots, not Norman.
Yeah. That's so 90s.
I was always way more of a Doc Ock over Green Goblin fan anyways, from way back in the day. Just seemed like Doc brought more interesting to the table. It was also the master planner for a while.
Yeah.
That being said, I enjoyed that Hobgoblin business in the 80s.
And Doc Ock at times was a kind of like a set up a little bit crime bossy too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have his weird stories where he would be like overweight and in some green spandex thing. And I'm like, oh, that's not the best Doc Ock stories. And you'd have the ones where he'd be rocking a business suit. And I'd be like, yeah, he's pretty good, but it would sort of balance each other out. But I feel like in modern times, with all like the work Dan Slott did with Doc Ock, like Doc Ock is definitely up there. Like he permanently, like if he wasn't up there for you before, like he definitely ascended to that and held on to that place.
Yep. He's just about equal with the Green Goblin is Spider-Man's ultimate nemesis at this point. For sure. All right, why don't we make that an episode, and then we can go back to our corners and get our cut men to work on us, and we can come out fighting again and get a second episode out this month and keep our semi-monthly train rolling again. So thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Kevin, for being with me as I serendipitously became redirected and unexpectedly took July off. Until Moondragon gets her bangs cut straight, make mine Marvel. Later.